to the best of Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, an interview from this past November. Alan First is widely considered to be today's best historical spy novelist. In fact, many critics compare his best work to Graham Greene or John le Carré, for his ability to transcend the popular fiction genre into literature. First is the author of 11 books in his Night Soldier series that capture the world of European espionage from 1933 to 1944. Set with different main characters in locales ranging from pre-war Paris to Warsaw to the Spanish Civil War and the Balkans, his books read as if they were translated books from the 1940s, a device that adds realism to the espionage genre. His latest book is Spies of the Balkan, released in 2010, set in Salonika, Greece, in the year prior to the German invasion. Alan First was the winner of this past year's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, given by the Tulsa Library Trust, and I spoke with him prior to his appearance in Tulsa back in late November of 2011. Alan First, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on winning the Helmrich Award.
Thank you so much.
I want to start by just going back to your first book in the Night Soldier series. You were writing for Esquire, and you'd written a couple other novels, but I guess there was an assignment that took you to somewhere in Central or Eastern Europe that sort of spurred the first story of the Night Soldier series.
Well, that's true. I had an assignment from Esquire to go up the Danube from Ismailia, which is in Romania, or was in Romania, now it's a Russian possession. But they made me go to Moscow for about 8 days. And what happened to me is that I had never been in a police state before. So this really, I mean, everything that I saw there, and it was pretty overt. It wasn't subtle, let me tell you. Kindled in me the desire to write about the 1930s and about the time when totalitarian countries were really the strongest places in Europe, meaning the USSR and Germany in the 1930s. So that's really what happened to me, and that's why I wrote these books. And before then, I really didn't quite have anything to write about, to tell you the truth. I mean, I wrote, you know, crime, sort of silly contemporary crime novels that were not very successful. But once I had something to write about, everything changed for me, and I started writing these novels about the 1930s.
You know, a lot of times when we think of espionage novels, we think of a single character. And this is something you will bring up characters in more than one book, but you've never done I think there was a couple of books that featured a French a filmmaker.
Film producer.
Yeah, film producer who, but you very quickly abandoned that idea of doing a series based on one character. You really pick a locale and create a character wherever you go. In the latest book, it's Constantine Zanis.
Yeah. Well, you know what I do is that the people in my books have vocations appropriate to the time. In other words, the people who seem to be powerful in that period are very different than people who are powerful now. But the people who were powerful then include, as in Spies of the Balkans, a senior police official. One is always, you see that reference all the time when you read in the period.
Uh-huh.
So that's the one I use this time. But in the past, I've used a film producer. I've used a former officer in who owns an advertising agency in Paris. I've used a couple of different journalists from the Soviet Union, from Romania. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's my system. And I try to find a lead character that's doing something that was done at that time.
Well, let's talk about the most recent book, Spies of the Balkans.
Okay.
Now, you actually started writing about the Balkans. I think the first one was set in Bulgaria, then it moves quickly to Paris. But, you know, the Balkans is this sort of unknown theater of World War II. I rank it up there with Scandinavia, filled with spies, The British were always there because, you know, Churchill always wanted to open the second front from the Balkans.
Right.
So how do you go about learning about a subject before you write about it?
I tend to find the political history of the country. And that is really hard. Sometimes I use an old Britannica because they have the greatest articles about nations, huge histories, endless, and tiny little print. and what I discovered is that if I actually not only read it, but learned it, which means read it 30, 40 times, because it's complicated, you know, what was the Hungarian Peasant Party and so on and so forth? I don't start knowing any more than anybody else, but I can learn it. And so I try to learn the political history of the country. And what that does is it gives you the idea for what the dark side of that history might be if you're going to be writing spy novels. So that it's, in a way, the intelligence history of a country is in a kind of shadow, but it's possible to infer it, I guess that's the right word, from the political history of the country. This sounds more complicated than it is, but it does take a certain amount of work. And these countries, the interesting thing about Europe, the 17 or so countries, however many there were, I'm not sure of my count there, each of them has a completely separate and different history and a completely separate and different nationhood, language, culture, politics, everything you can think of. So that, in a funny way, that was the opening for me to write a series of books because I have all kinds of places nationally that I can use as a background for these stories.
And of course, we forget our own history during the 1930s in the United States. You know, there was everything from socialists, communists, to fascists in America who were all taking advantage of the economic dislocation from the Great Depression to press home their case. Now, in our case, it was nothing more than fringe politics, but you had all of that going on in varying degrees across all the nations of Europe. So you had that intrigue.
Yeah, absolutely. America in the 1930s was isolationist, which means if these people over there want to fight their little wars, let them. Why should American boys die over there? Because that's what had just happened.
Yeah.
It had just happened in 1918. So now it's 20 years later in 1938, you know, and Americans are going, well, you know, that nice Wilson boy down the street went to France and he never came home. So, like, and it didn't do any good. So why should we do it again?
Yeah. But in the countries of Europe, what's interesting is your characters seem to be very good, very bad. But the governments and the sort of the times that they're living in is very unsettled, very gray. For example, in Greece, you have Metaxas, who's running the country. Western Europe has been overrun. All the countries of the Balkans say, well, we're probably next. And in fact, they were. In Greece, Metaxas was his own sort of strongman dictator in his own way. And so you have all this sort of murky grayness around a lot of these countries.
That was the situation. Let's just say that it was transitional. Because first, you have to remember, in a country like Romania, 90% of the population was illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
It was peasants. Real peasants in the sense that we think about some poor man laboring with an ox in a field. And not only that, but a lot of these countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Yugoslavia, they all had kings, functioning kings. This is not that long ago. But the idea that today there would be, you know, that the important individual in Greece would be the king is ridiculous. I mean, that time's over. But it was still, Europe was still partly back in the Middle Ages in the 1930s.
Of course, you still had some of the leftovers from the pre-World War I, is which you had a bunch of nationalities put together. In Greece, you had Macedonians, Greeks.
Right.
To the north in Yugoslavia, you had Croats, Serbs, of course, Bosnians, which, of course, we all became aware of in the 1990s.
Right.
But you had all these ethnic tensions simmering that the Nazis would later exploit.
Well, they were simmering because a lot of those nations had been under occupation for 300 years. 300 years is a long time to be under occupation. Poland became a country again in 1918, and it hadn't been a country since 1757 or something like that. I know I don't have the date right, but that's not far off. And it had been part of the Russian Empire, as well as Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. And then if you move down into the Balkans, those people had been under Turkish domination for 300 years, under the Ottoman Empire. They fought, you know, Greece got free in 1912, part of Greece. The part around Athens had freed itself earlier. But again, when you look at 1912 and say 1938, it isn't that long. they had only had their countries as republics or democracies or whatever, social democracies, whatever they were trying to do. They had only had their countries for a couple of decades.
Yeah. And in fact, your characters in Spies of the Balkans, that's sort of the conflict they refer to. It's, well, just as we threw out the Turks, you know, we're going to have to resist at first the Italians who invaded. And this is the period your novel is set in. The Italians have invaded Greece. Constantine is called up, but he's basically seeing what, and of course a lot of the officials are saying, we throw out the Italians, but the Nazis are going to come. The Germans are coming. And a lot of the novel reflects on that preparation, really, for the fact that they're not going to win. They know they're not going to win.
That's the kind of Greek tragedy that actually happened. I just talk about it in my novel, but it's real. It's true. It really happened. By November of 1940, the Greeks knew that the more they beat back the Italians and chased them back into Albania, every victory they won meant that Hitler and Germany would have to attack them sooner, since the Axis powers could not sustain a loss, and certainly not sustain a loss to a little country like Greece. 8 million people. That's all.
Yeah. The other story that is a part of this book is getting the Jews out of Germany. And Constantine gets involved with a way of getting people out of Germany, Jews out of Europe, really, and to the Middle East, to Turkey. What's really interesting is, you know, we have this sort of view of Nazi Germany as being sort of this monolithic, all-knowing, all-seeing evil empire. And in fact, your book sort of point out that, no, that they were, you know, they were not all, they were certainly evil, but they were not all-seeing, all-knowing. Your book has several scenes where it sort of defies our contemporary view of what you could and couldn't do in World War II, as far as, say, fly from Paris to Romania without, you know, the Germans knowing everything about what happened. Did that come out of your research?
Yes, it surely did. I mean, the Germans, the Nazis, projected themselves as omnipotent and all-seeing and all-knowing. But the fact of the matter is they weren't. They were bribable. If you paid enough money, you could do anything you wanted to. They were very venal. In other words, they were corrupt, and that left an opening for people, A. B, people, you got to understand, people under pressure, under huge stress, meaning live or die, can be incredibly ingenious, just amazingly so. And that's sort of what I write about. The people who became opposition and successful opposition to these people. And they did it, you know, by imagination, by craft, by deviance, by every means possible. And it's a great story. It's not just my great story. It's on television, you know what I'm saying, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a great story about how people fought back against brutality.
My guest today is novelist Alan First. He is the author of 11 World War II-era espionage novels, the latest of which is Spies of the Balkans. One of the things I love about your novels is we think of espionage novels as going on during wartime. A lot of your espionage novels take place in the days leading up, you know, the preparation. There's a great scene that you describe in, I think it's Bulgaria, and the police colleague of Zanes is talking about, oh yeah, we're just seeing some clean-cut tourists coming down with fancy cameras, taking pictures of the harbor and the local sites. And you know, that was sort of the preparation. These guys were agents. They were basically landscaping the layout for when they would come eventually.
Absolutely. Thousands of them all over Eastern Europe. Every one of them with a Leica. I mean, you really have to wonder about Germany. They'd send all these people. They'd be wearing alpine hats with feathers in them. Five men traveling together. What? And all with Leicas. What? You know, I mean, and soldiers don't look like other people. They're bigger and stronger, and they're not fat or anything. And here are all these tourists, quote, wandering around Eastern Europe, and everybody knew who they were. There wasn't any question about that. But on the other hand, they did what they were sent to do, and it didn't matter that people knew what they were. They went and took photographs of the harbors and the bridges and airfields and the things that countries want to know about before they launch invasions.
Of course, you set these books in the lead-up to the actual warfare, which
right.
I think is a really interesting idea, the idea that whether it is one country infiltrating another or another defending against that infiltration, that seems to be a particular area of emphasis for you. And I guess it creates really interesting storylines.
Well, it does, because when you look back at World War II, and if you start with the invasion of Poland in 1939 and then go backwards, you go, how did this happen? How was this done? How did the Germans manage to be so incredibly successful? I mean, by 1940 in June, they basically had the whole continent. That hadn't been done for a long time, if ever. But they managed to do it. But it's also true that people in these small countries found ways to fight back and to try to fight back. A lot of the operations in my books are not successful, but they are successful in the sense that people tried to do it and they did something. They didn't stop the war. They didn't destroy Hitler. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. But that's not the way the world works. The way the world works is a lot of little things happen first, and that's what I write about. And they're not little things. A, B, they're true. The Brits and the French really did try to stop the oil going from Romania to Germany. That's one book. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. I mean, through all the books, the Greeks couldn't do anything about the German invasion. But before the German invasion came, Salonika, which is where Spies of the Balkans takes place, really was the back door to Europe. And it was a place that fugitives ran to because they could get out and go to one of two places, either Turkey or Alexandria, the British part of the British Empire in Egypt.
My guest today is Alan First. His most recent book is titled Spies of the Balkan, his 11th work of World War II-era espionage. Each book set in a different part of the sort of timeline in the era between World War I and World War II, and in various countries as well. Most have something to do with Paris. In fact, there's a one bistro that appears in every single one of your books, the Brasserie Heiniger. Now tell us why that brasserie shows up in every book.
Well, it's a very odd thing. I used it in the first book, and I liked the idea of having a sort of central point in these books that the hero always visits, although each time in entirely different circumstances. But first of all, it actually is a real brasserie in Paris, near where I used to live in Paris.
I would assume it's someplace you frequented.
Yeah, it was at the time. It's really not all that good anymore, to tell you the truth. It's Bofinger, B-O-F-I-N-G-E-R. It's okay. People who are readers of my books go in there, ask to sit at table 14. There is no table 14. They look for the bullet hole in the mirror. There is no bullet hole. There is no mirror. But it's nice to think that people kind of have belief in it in that particular way. But this is a series, after all. So there are places and people that keep coming up. Now, Paris, in the time that I'm writing about, was the heart of Europe. And in a lot of ways, it was the heart of Western civilization. It was the great prize. When Paris fell in 1940, June, hundreds and hundreds of Poles committed suicide in Poland because they felt that the world was over. If Paris, that beacon of liberty and sensuality and equality and all good things, could go under, could be taken and dominated by the Nazis, then there was no hope. Now, this didn't turn out to be the case, but it did scare people, and really it upset them. Because Paris was, if Poland was bad, at least Paris was good and maybe they could get there. I mean, there's an awful lot of Polish emigres in Paris.
Right. It was like, well, American emigres, too, that came east.
Right, but in quite a different way. The Poles, first of all, couldn't go back and the Americans could.
Yeah.
And the Poles had no money at all and Americans were rich.
Yeah.
So they came there in quite different ways. But yes, there's a lot of American expatriates in Paris, as was I, and it's a kind of little country inside Paris, a sort of separate little nation, American expatriates. And then the expatriates of all the other places, Eastern Europe, the United Kingdom, et cetera, and so forth.
Well, one of the things reviewers have commented on is many of your books sort of read as if they were translated from another language. I think you've commented on that as well. Was that a particular sort of stylistic point to create
this?
Yeah,
well, I'm not smart enough to go, aha, I'll do it this way. I'm sorry, I'd like to be. But the fact is that I discovered I was doing it. But this is novelist land, which is a very strange place. But I discovered, having been reading excessively in translated books about the period, that I had started to write in that way, and I just continued to do it. First of all, my books are written in 1940s narrative fiction language. They are not written in contemporary language. It's actually kind of hard to do sometimes, but they read like 1940s novels, and they're supposed to, and they read like 1940s translated novels, and that's intentional as well. It's not, I mean, it won't slow people down. I have to say at this point, these are entertaining books, or at least I hope they are. They're meant to be. They're meant to be taken on a plane. They're meant to be taken to the beach. They're meant to be on your night table. And this makes them sound much more complicated than they are.
And have you been surprised by the fact that, you know, the mystery and spy novel category is kind of, it's popular fiction, but your books have sort of transcended that sort of, you know, I don't know if it's a snob divide or what, if you want you to call it, but they're considered literature.
Yeah, I know, and that's really very curious. That happened. It was not my intention, and it happened slowly, and it happened over time. But the fact of the matter is that reviewers and people who have interviewed me for the media and various readers in their emails have said this over time, so that I changed the designation of the books from spy novels to novels about spies, which is not quite the same thing. No, it is the same thing? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Well, what's interesting is you tend to really wrap yourself in this era. I assume that you're constantly devouring, you know, old magazines, old books, histories about this particular era. Now, you know, you've been in Poland, you've been in several parts of the Balkans, the Spanish Civil War, Paris. You told in the Foreign Correspondent, you told a wonderful story about the Italian expatriates that left fascism in Italy and moved to Paris and then found themselves surrounded by fascism again.
Here it came again,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. But are there areas that you haven't mined yet? I'm thinking of Scandinavia, which, you know, was filled with spies because most of Scandinavia was neutral.
It's very different from nation to nation.
Yeah.
If you really look at Scandinavia, Norway, which was early occupied by the Germans because they thought, and in fact they probably were right, that that was the natural base for Great Britain to attack the continent of Europe. It was a very good place for Britain. They didn't want the Brits there, and they needed the iron routes down from Scandinavia to Germany because they couldn't have fought the war otherwise. So you had Norway in absolute full 100% resistance. And then you had Sweden, which was neutral and did rather well during the war. I mean, it would be hard for me to write a book about Sweden because they did okay in World War II. So did Switzerland. Well, yeah. I'm sorry. You know, like they have the Nobel, and that's really cool, and it's $1 million. But the fact of the matter is they really saved their skin in World War II. And then you come to a place like Finland, theoretically, or in fact allied with Germany because they were fighting a war with the Soviet Union. That's completely yet a third case. And then Denmark, which had a kind of gentleman's occupation, although the Danes were very good about saving the Jews of Denmark. They did do that, and they deserve credit for it. But it's also true, I mean, look at the map. Denmark really is Germany. I mean, it's on the same land almost.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at Schleswig-Holstein, there's a little border there, and then you're in Denmark. But the Danes are very fierce, very independent people. The Germans respected them so that they didn't have a bad occupation. A bad occupation was Poland. A good occupation, quote, was Denmark.
Well, I assume you're working on a new novel at this point, Spies.
I sure am.
And can you tell us anything about it, or should we wait?
I can tell you a little bit. The title is A Mission to Paris. It takes place in Paris, in very, very upper-class Paris, in 1938, as Paris begins to fold, which is what happened about 2 years before they were invaded. And that's basically the story of this book. I don't think I can say too much more about it now, but basically that is the story. So it's set in upper-class Paris, and it starts just around the time of the Munich appeasement by France and England.
The fall of the Third Republic.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is a great political story.
It is a great political story, and I think, I've never read this before. I've never read another book about this. For whatever reason, when I've talked to Random House about this the last couple of months or so, I've said, you know, the curious part of this, I didn't intend to do it, but it's really not a well-known story or a story that's known in any way at all. But you know it, obviously, because you refer to it.
William Shire wrote a book about the fall, and it was about the infighting that basically made them immune to the looming danger from Nazi Germany.
Right, unable to respond to it, really.
Yeah.
And terrible political things went on. And when you get down into what really happened and what it was really like, it's reasonably, it's not a nice story. But there is, again, very good people who struggled to try to make that not happen.
Well, we look forward to that. And in the meantime, congratulations again on the Helmreich Award. Alan First, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alan First speaking with us in late November of last year. His new book, Mission to Paris, comes out next month. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.